Celebrating diversity, this is Bristol's BCFM 93.2.
No king ever existed without the permission of the priesthood. I don't care what religion you're talking about or what period of history you're talking about, it is the truth. The kings never had the power and don't to this day. Kings exist at the whim of the real power, which is the priesthood standing behind the throne. And when the king ceased to be of benefit to the priesthood, they would simply poison him or get rid of him in some other way. The king is dead, long live the king, and there would be another king appointed.
Welcome back to BCFM's Politics Show with Irish Republican Labour activist Martin Summers and me, Tony Gosling. Also former Sunday Times journalist Kevin Cahill. Another election in Israel, the third this year, and something's clearly not working. Perhaps it's that Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu refuses to hand over power to someone that might have him prosecuted. Perhaps the only thing keeping him from trial and jail is the fact that he's Prime Minister. Well, sounds a bit medieval, doesn't it? The Crusades. And YouTube once more shut down Iran's Press TV account, not giving any reason. Well, what does this say about the power of the parent company, Google? Why should we be worried that we can no longer see what's coming out of so-called font of all Middle Eastern terrorism, Tehran? That state run by Muslims, isn't it? Plus, the Pentagon's secret project, Maven, artificial intelligence drone killers. Is this the future of warfare? Drones with no conscience? And Greta Thunberg has been speaking again about climate change, but what of her handler stroke guide, Luisa Neubauer? One man who was sentenced to death in absentia in Nuremberg, World War II fugitive, Hitler's private secretary, Nazi party treasurer, Martin Bormann. We hear this week about his way with women. Ugh, and how the May the 1st, 1945 Fleming rescue tale, Ian Fleming that is, dovetails nicely with the official story. Our sister show Dialects here on BCFM on Tuesday at noon. This week, from militant atheist to Church of England minister, Simon Bale takes us through nearly 30 years working with the churches of Bristol. They got together, but why didn't they stay together? You can listen here at BCFM 93.2 at noon next Tuesday or download that show right now from dialectradio.co.uk. We start this week with the shutdown by Google of Press TV's YouTube account, Martin. This is about the fourth of Press TV's YouTube accounts that's been shut down by Google, by YouTube. The idea really here being, it seems, that they just don't want people to be finding this stuff. You know, it takes, for example, some of the big networks like the BBC, etc., have got hundreds of thousands or millions of subscribers to their channel because they've built that up over the years. Every 6 months or so, YouTube take out their channel at Press TV and stop them uploading any further videos. That means they have to start all over again.
It does, and it's basically petty harassment of them. The only positive from their point of view is the banned in Boston syndrome, where if you've never looked at Press TV, you've have to ask yourself the question, why do they want to ban it? And that might get some of the more radical people out there to think, I need to take a look at this. Certainly in the past, whenever I see things that are being banned, I think I need to see that.
This is a bit of competition between you and me, isn't it? Because your channel's not banned, RT, but mine is.
That's because the Russians have got nuclear weapons.
Anyway, this isn't the first time Press TV's been banned, Kevin. They were also banned about 7 or 8 years ago by Ofcom. So we're not allowed to watch it on any of our satellite channels or cable channels here. or Freeview.
Censorship is censorship, but Google is an interesting, YouTube and Google are interesting. The House of Commons has described Google and YouTube as criminal corporations. Don't worry, we're safe. It's privileged and you can't be sued for liable. So two criminal corporations suppress Press TV, which isn't a criminal corporation and has no convictions against it.
Well, it's a state broadcaster. They would say that they're putting out content which is offensive, that sort of thing. I think there was some sort of hint that there was an attack in the United States during the week, Martin, and that someone had been commenting, well, maybe it was a false flag attack or that sort of thing. So trying to critique the attack in a way that offended somebody, they complain to YouTube and then YouTube shuts the channel down.
Well, let's face it. I mean, there is massive censorship going on by Google and others. And that's what you'd expect them to do.
Where are Google censoring?
Well, because of the algos that they're now using, basically are downgrading, and for years they've refused to monetize stuff, which they don't like.
Well, that's right. There's people like Luke Rutkowski and myself about 3 or 4 years ago, we were demonetized. They basically send you a little note and say, we're no longer at the advertiser's space, no longer want to advertise on your channel, and therefore no more money for you.
Well, yes, and of course people like Elliot Abrams, who've got zero credibility, and are actually funded by the National Endowment for Democracy and the Integrity Initiative, all the rest of it, they're not downgraded. So the original internet was quite a radical force, because it gave fairly small fry a chance to create a platform for themselves. But now we're getting consolidation of this industry and this whole technique. And basically, people think when they go on their phones that they're, if they put in a search term, that they're going to get everything that's there. But in actual fact, they don't. And can you see that?
They actually don't get what they're looking for. Yeah, that's 50 pages down the search.
That's
term.
Right. And this is so even if you're looking for something and you actually know exactly what you're looking for, they've put it down or they've taken it away.
The other aspect of this
we're being mind controlled.
There's a study in the United States, which I'll put up a link to on our show page at thisweek.org.uk, which we've been discussing in the Journalists Union. In fact, there's a very narrow vote about it at the last conference. There's going to be another conference. I think the next one is at the end of April this year. And this is over the algorithms, Kevin, that Google use, being able to skew results for particular candidates in elections. So they reckon that by use of a Google algorithm, a particular candidate can return 30% more or 30% less favourable searches. So you can find a lot of nasty things about a person depending on the algorithm, or nice things about them depending on whether Google wants you to. And of course, as a commercial organisation, it's quite feasible that someone has just come along to them and say, we're going to pay you however many billion dollars to make our candidate look good.
Yeah. Well, what do you expect from a criminal corporation? I mean,
in what way do you say Google is criminal then?
Google, the House of Commons published sworn evidence in April last year. Let's pick out Google. Google had 9 months to say the evidence was wrong. They didn't show up.
What was the evidence about? What are we talking about?
Yeah, we're talking about the criminal mass surveillance that Google is doing for the United States Espionage Agency, the National Security Agency.
Okay, so this is basically British citizens, I imagine, including kids, having information about them sold or sent over to US intelligence.
Correct. And the House of Commons evidence is based on court judgments. It's not anybody's opinion. It's the progressive judgments of the Irish High Court, the European Court of Justice, the Investigatory Powers Commissioner. You know, this isn't somebody's opinion. These are court judgments.
Martin, what is it that Google doesn't like about the Muslim state of Iran, the Iranian Republic of Iran?
Well,
basically, the Iranians are basically under sanctions. They're trying to cut them off from the world economy, and of course these are acts of war. I mean, Japan, when that was being done to them in the 40s, struck back at Pearl Harbor. Mm-hmm. And, of course, the Iranians are being pushed to strike back so that they can then go in all in to try and
attack. Is it kind
them.
Of provocation, in a way?
Of course it is. The Iranians just have to roll their eyes and put up with it, because if they do strike back, they'll be giving them what they want. It's very difficult in this world to get. I mean, one of the things about Press TV, if you watch it, people have this image of Iran as this terribly dour place with people in black clothes on and sort of big moustaches and beards and frowns. But of course, Press TV is actually quite lively and interesting. It's just different, and of course, that then starts to make Iran seem sort of like normal,
you know, I
just
feel
a
like,
normal place.
I mean, this
which
show,
it is, of course.
This show, of course, is a bit different to the sort of thing you hear on the mainstream media. So it does seem as if there's a kind of groupthink developing in the media where you're supposed to think a certain thing.
Well, that's right. I mean, I would argue that it's absolutely in the public interest for people to be able to access the propaganda, if that's what it was, is of the Iranians, because you might as well find out what they're saying and what they think. Why not, even if you disagree with it profoundly?
Kevin, William Joyce, Lord Haw-Haw in the Second World War, was a British lord who was broadcasting from Nazi Germany. I think it was actually on the same frequency as Radio Luxembourg, the same transmitter, back in the 1970s and 80s. Much more famous Luxembourg was amongst my generation. I didn't realise that it was being used in the Second World War to do propaganda speeches in a British voice to the UK. But in the Second World War, in their wisdom or otherwise, the broadcasting regulators decided they weren't going to jam Lord Haw-Haw. Well, what they would do is do things like ridicule him and also critique him, maybe even quote him sometimes in the newspapers and say, well, we don't agree with what he's saying, this sort of thing. So actually, censorship and jamming, this sort of thing, doesn't always work, does it?
No, and it's cowardly. We, the United Kingdom, were able to sort of laugh at William Joyce because we were sufficiently courageous. We knew, if you like, we were in the right and we could deal. But Google is an agent of the United States government. And like I say, it's not my opinion.
It's a private corporation, actually.
No, it's not. It's a paid agent. And none of our national media have reported the court.
Well, Eric Schmidt would pick a bone with you over that, wouldn't he? He would say he's his own man.
Who?
Eric Schmidt.
No, the contracts that Google have with the United States spooks are a matter of public records in the courts.
But they're still a private corporation.
No, that's secondary.
Well, I think that's right. This division between public and private just doesn't exist. I mean, if you're basically being paid by the government, how independent are you? Elliot Higgins, running Bellingcat, is supposedly independent, except they've got a staff of 15 and they're all being paid salaries by the National Endowment for Democracy. So it's like quangos, quasi-non-governmental organisations.
What it seems has happened to me, it has happened over the last 30, 40 years, is we've seen more and more biased reporting on the mainstream press and on television. People have been rather, you know, sick of that, and so they're going onto social media, they're going onto places like Google, looking on Google News, this sort of thing, to find out what's going on, sharing it on social media, particularly young people. Some just don't read any newspapers, watch any television, so they don't believe it. And now, what seems to be happening is those social media platforms like, you know, YouTube and Facebook, which is sharing YouTube all over the place, they're being closed down now, Martin, and being people being corralled on there too.
Well, that's right. I mean, basically, the Wild West era of the internet, where people could, you know, I remember it coming in. I used to communicate when GreenNet was just getting going. I was working in the New Economics Foundation. I used to have to communicate with most of my contacts in Eastern Europe by snail mail. I had a whole list of people to write to, and I sent them letters, you know, like Samizdat.
But nowadays, those letters that people are sending on email are all under surveillance. Now, this is what the next stage, really, is looking at how this is all operating with the National Security Agency. We had Catherine Gunn on last week on this program talking about that and her experience dealing with the NSA in the run-up to the Iraq war. But the problem here, of course, is that they're creating this mass surveillance system, Kevin. doing. And we may say, well, you've got nothing to, if you've done nothing wrong, you've got nothing to hide. Well, actually, what happens when that mass surveillance system, hang on, what happens when that mass surveillance system is used to pick out specific people of particular political views, particular religious groups? We've seen that in the 1930s, and IBM was involved in the Holocaust, for goodness sake. They were making money renting out these machines, these Hollerith machines, to the SS, who were then using those machines to pick people off. So what we're doing is we're setting up probably the biggest and most dangerous mass surveillance system in history.
Tony, can I push you back on something crucial? You said, if you have nothing to hide, you have nothing to fear. Before you get to that point, there are laws. There are charters. There are privacy laws. And those privacy laws don't allow people like Google the freedom to say, we can spy on you because if you've got nothing to hide, you've got nothing to fear. The answer to that is, you're breaking the law, Google.
Well, many would say that the legal system, this country and elsewhere, I mean, look at the International Criminal Court, for example. You know, Bush and Blair still dancing around, even though they're some of the greatest war criminals of the 21st century. So, I mean, the legal system is not necessarily robust enough to deal with this, though, Kevin.
Well, it's this particular surveillance case, the court judgments, which have never been reported by the mainstream media here, has wandered on for 6 years. The judgments have come in, the judges have said and named the companies, you know, they are spying for the National Security Agency, it's a criminal offence, and nothing has happened.
Martin, what can people do if they're finding that they're not able to access what they want on social media? Is there anything, or is that it? When YouTube just closes down Press TV, where do we go?
Well, I mean, you can still, I presume there are still ways to access Press TV if you've got sufficient knowledge.
Well, I would imagine they've done what they did the previous times, is they start again from scratch with two subscribers with another channel on YouTube.
Yeah. Well, I mean, you can do it that way. I mean, because of the monopoly control that Google and others have and Facebook, they should actually be treated as public utilities and therefore regulated in what they do. Like a lot of other industries, the private sector, and the internet was developed as a military institution in the first place. It was designed for the military and then expanded to the rest of the society. So it wasn't created by the private sector in the first place. These people are just feudal barons who've been handed these fiefdoms to run.
Okay. To take you back to the issue of the law, the Austrian former student Schrems proved and got his judgment in the European Court of Justice 5 years ago. He's still fighting. The companies he got the judgment against, Google, YouTube, Facebook, Microsoft, and so on, have just totally ignored the law. But so have our government. Our government has betrayed us on this issue.
Yeah, but I mean, what are we going to do about it? Because I mean, you're living in, and we're talking in a way about a similar thing going on over in Israel. We'll be talking about that in a second. But where Netanyahu is so powerful in Israel that it looks like he's not going to be prosecuted, even though apparently he's being charged. The charges aren't going to happen, and they're going for another election over there. So the law really seems to be something which is. Okay, if you're rich and powerful, looking at, you know, people like Epstein, for example, there's another case, this Weinstein case in the United States. And I'm not saying that this is in the UK, but I mean, we're seeing all over the Western world, we're seeing cases of the justice system simply breaking down, not working, where people are coming up with clear evidence that someone's broken the law. They then do a deal with lawyers and nothing happens.
Yeah, no, I mean, as I say, with all the surveillance stuff, it was the former High Court Judge Anthony May, who said, this is criminal and this is unlawful. And he said it to Parliament, and Parliament accepted it.
The breakdown of law and order, Martin. I mean, for example, with Epstein, as soon as the law actually does start to do its work, oh dear, Mr. Epstein's dead.
Well, the fact that the powerful are scoff laws is not an argument against having laws in principle. Without laws, there is no rules. And if there are no rules, then there's no society, basically. And but that doesn't mean that we can accept the class-based justice that we face.
I mean, look at Assange, for example. That whole situation there with the military families actually being involved with the judge that's making decisions about this guy's future.
He's also being held in defiance of habeas corpus on a completely specious charge, which isn't even illegal in British law. I mean, you know, the famous lawyers of the past would be rolling in their graves to watch that.
Okay, real quick. What's wrong with the law is called agency. We have, all three of us here, have a right to privacy. But the agent who is inserted in the system to enforce that is a bureaucrat. In our country, it's Elizabeth Denham, the information commissioner. Elizabeth Denham has not taken a single case against any of the criminal corporations conducting daily criminal acts in the United Kingdom. That's the catch.
So what do we do about that?
Dead simple. If there's a law that says you, I, and Martin have a right to privacy, open the door of the local county court so that we don't have to go through Elizabeth Denham. We go into the county court, we put in a writ, put in our 50 quid and get judgment there and then against the crooks.
Good idea. Right. Anyway, Israel will hold an unprecedented third election in a year, we hear 2 days ago. Members of the Knesset voted to set the election date for the 2nd of March, hours after a midnight deadline passed earlier this week. Netanyahu and his main rival, Benny Gantz, were unable to secure majorities following September's inconclusive election. So, again, a long period, Martin, of a sort of power vacuum, really, because, well, it's not a power vacuum because Netanyahu's managing to stay in. It's just there seems to be almost like the Indians are circling in the old cowboy films.
Well, yes, I mean, it's an internal squabble within the elite inside Israel. It doesn't really have much significance for the Palestinians, who are, you know, Benny Gantz, who's likely to take over if Netanyahu is removed, is equally belligerent. You know,
isn't the temptation for Netanyahu to actually start a fight with
neighboring country? Yeah, that is definitely a danger that Netanyahu, in order to avoid being impeached, will. I mean, you know,
can you not get votes by appearing to be the strong man?
Oh yeah, well that's what he's been trying to do. I mean, that's pretty clear.
I don't want to suggest things.
The recent attacks in Gaza were initiated by the Israelis as a way of distracting attention from Netanyahu's difficulties. You know, the temptation to wag the dog for him is very dangerous.
Yeah, Tony, you took us back to medieval times about Netanyahu. But what lots of people on the doorstep talked about in the election is Boris Johnson. Boris Johnson has twice been found guilty by two Supreme Courts of heinous, really serious crimes. He lied to the Queen and he shut down Parliament unlawfully. And now what does he get by way of a reward? He gets to be the Prime Minister.
Well, there was a time in medieval times where lying to the Queen might have really serious consequences.
Absolutely.
So we'll see. Anyway, if the Queen is... this is another thing. We didn't have you here last week, Kevin, but it's a bit... What do you think of the significance of this supposed leak last week about the Queen doing an 18-month stint and then handing over to Prince Charles, who might become a prince consort along with Camilla?
Historically, when I was doing the wealth of the Queen in the rich list, I thought she would hand over long ago from remarks she had made. She said she would not treat her son as Victoria treated Bertie. But she's 93 now, and Charles is still the heir apparent.
So do you think it'd make any difference in 18 months' time? I mean, it may be, actually. Is it? No, hang on. She'll have two more Christmas messages to do.
Yep.
3 o'clock on Christmas Day. I hope everyone will be watching, of course. Yes, and saluting to the television, standing up straight and all that sort of thing. Yeah. Anyway, I mean, in constitutional terms, would it make any difference at all if Prince Charles takes over from the Queen?
No, I don't think so. There'd be small differences.
Different personalities?
Different personalities.
Same personalities. And does the personality matter for someone in that position?
Not a lot.
Martin?
Well, no, I tend to agree. It's not, I mean, people obsess about this, and it's part of the control mechanism. We worry, and people who even don't like the monarchy banging.
But they are still extremely powerful, aren't they?
They are more powerful than people think. They're influential, and they're very much the establishment. But
especially with we
really need to be talking about more fundamental people who run the country. Most people, have never heard of.
My view is that the Queen is actually quite a different personality to Prince Charles. Mm. That she's someone who went through the Second World War, and she's got a bit of more of an understanding of what that means. Whereas Charles is a bit of a Johnny come lately. I mean, although of course he is not a young man, but he's kind of ambitious. He wants to change the world. He talks to plants, this sort of thing. And I'm not sure he's. There was a lot of criticism from Diana saying, "Look, this guy's just not going to make a good monarch." So, and there's definitely this interesting attack on Epstein on Prince Andrew via the Epstein thing, which makes me wonder whether maybe Charles is nervous that there is a feeling in the country that he's not going to be up to the job and that someone else should take the job. Anyway, what do you think?
No, there's been a follow-up that Charles and William are planning a reduction in the number of royals on the public payroll.
But not them.
Of course not. But in most countries of the world, if you're the head of state, you list your assets. And none of the royal family list any of their assets.
Well, I mean, Prince Charles was in the Panama Papers, wasn't he? And he'd been shown in there that he was making a lot of money from all this international carbon trading, and he hadn't declared it. So that's another aspect to all of this, which we'll be hearing about in a minute. Because, can I just get both of you's both of you's thoughts on the climate talks that have been going on and how that's all been going? I mean, do you think this is a really, really number one issue, number two, three, four, or not a waste of time, Kevin?
If you're in the Marshall Islands, it's tonight with the waves coming up your door. It's worth having these big conferences, though they still haven't become effective. They keep the issue before ordinary people. And that little girl from Sweden is extraordinary. She's the best thing ever to happen. Her and David Attenborough should both be given Nobel Prizes.
Martin?
Well, I'm more sceptical than Kevin about this, but I think the real issue is that we've got a planet with massive ecological challenges and also huge inequalities and the potential for a nuclear war, which really will change the climate if it takes place. And I think the carbon trading, I was involved in the discussions about this many years ago when I was at NEF, and it was very clear that the more radical NGOs like Oxfam, Greenpeace, were not interested in carbon trading, because that's just another hedge fund speculator market. And the idea that we're going to solve this with some market solution is wrong. You've got to make physical plans for physical quantities, how much coal you're going to burn.
How about with Prince Charles taking his little pound of fresh bit of carbon?
That's very significant, yeah? Mm. Because there's what you might call a greenwash wing of the multinationals, which wants to push climate change as a means of creating more pseudo-markets for their speculative investments. And ultimately, you've got to say, if we're serious about reducing our, not just our carbon footprint, but our footprint full stop. So, digging, drilling for oil doesn't just mess up the planet. It messes up where you're drilling as well, as many indigenous people will tell you. Ultimately, we've just got to stop being so destructive. And the system of capitalism, which is based on this kind of rapacious approach to human society, has got to be changed.
Okay, so we're going to hear not from Greta Thunberg, but her guide, Luisa Neubauer, who's a young German graduate and politician now in Germany. And here is an extract from her Munich TED Talk. Do you want to just say what is a TED Talk? Because I keep seeing these things popping up on the internet. Do you know Martin or Kevin?
Yeah, they're supposed to be free format talks where serious people can give their thoughts. The most important one this year was Carol Cadwalladr's from The Guardian. She lacerated Facebook and the whole gang, but again, no effect.
Well, yeah, I suppose enlightening people a bit has some effect, doesn't it?
Well, wouldn't it have been much better if she said, by the way, Facebook is carrying a series of serious criminal convictions. I forgot to mention that.
That might have helped. And also, we need someone to actually prosecute those convictions and make sure people pay for them. But anyway, let's have a listen now to this German lady, Luisa Neubauer, who's a very close friend and guide now of Greta Thunberg.
Leaving the zone of convenience works best when you join forces. One person asking for inconvenient change is mostly inconvenient. 2, 5, 10, 100 people asking for inconvenient change are hard to ignore. The more you are, the harder it gets for people to justify a system that has no future. Power is not something that you either have or don't have. Power is something you either take or leave to others, and it grows once you share it. We young people on the streets, we school strikers, we are showing how this can work out. One single school striker will always be one single school striker, or Greta Thunberg. 2, 5, 10, 1,000 people striking school are a movement, and that's what we need everywhere. No pressure. I need you to start taking yourselves more seriously. If there's one thing I've learned during 7 months of organizing climate action, is that if you don't go for something, chances are high that no one else will. The most powerful institutions of this world have no intention of changing the game they're profiting from most. So there's no point in further relying on them. That's scary, I know. That's a huge responsibility, a huge burden on everyone's shoulders, yes. But this also means, if we want to, we can have a say in this. We can be part of that change. We can be part of that answer. And that's quite beautiful, right? So let's give it a try. Let's rock and roll. Let's flood the world with climate activists. Let's get out of the zones of convenience and join forces and start taking ourselves more seriously. Imagine what this world would look like where children would grow up knowing their future was this one great adventure to look forward to, nothing to be scared of. What this world would look like where the next climate conference is this great happening of people who come together, who had heard the voices of millions, who would then roll up their sleeves ready to create real change. You know, I dream of this world where geography classes teach about the climate crisis as this one greatest challenge that was won by people like you and me who had started acting in time because they'd understood they had nothing to lose and everything to win. So why not give it a go? No one else will save this future for us. This is more than an invitation. Spread the word. Thank you.
She's not even speaking in German. That English is very impressive. It's kids like her and Thunberg. I suppose she's not a kid, but when they're up and marching, things can be made to change. But we should never forget that the real hero, the person who's done the most to get people to be aware of things, is David Attenborough.
Martin, there's also questions of funding of these sorts of movements. What did you make of what you heard there?
Well, that was Greta, was it not?
No, that is right. What's her name? Louisa Neubauer.
Okay,
Neubauer.
So, well, that's refreshing because it means that there's more people than Greta making these points. I see the climate emergency as, in a way, it's a way to kind of mobilise the relatively privileged on the planet to care about what's happening for the poor and the downtrodden. We can't seem to get them to care about them for themselves, but the whole climate change narrative is almost that if we don't do something, we're going to suffer and of course, ultimately, if we don't do something about what's going on the planet in the underprivileged part of the world, we are going to pay a price. But I don't think it's as straightforward as it's just going to be a climate price. The price is already being paid in shattered lives in Afghanistan and Iraq and homeless veterans of these wars sleeping on our own streets and so on.
I mean, there has been some criticism of Neubauer. She's published a book called Nature's Thumbprint, The New Genetics of Personality, which includes discussion of a controversial long-term study of adoptive Jewish twins. and triplets separated during infancy. Neither the children nor their adoptive parents were aware of the real reason they were being studied, or that the children had identical siblings. Some of the twins eventually learned their separation had been deliberate as a nature versus nurture experiment by Neubauer. So, it's, I mean, some questions about integrity.
That doesn't sound very ethical to me. You shouldn't be separating people to try and carry out experiments. The point is, there is clearly a climate change industry developing. Yeah, some parts of industry, like the oil industry, in fact, is actually helping to fund this because they want to control their own opposition. And I'm afraid that's an awful lot of that goes on.
Well, there is an opposition to Neubauer and Greta Thunberg, but one of those people, part of that, died this week. It's David Bellamy, who used to be very well known on British television as a scientist, an environmentalist, and he was what they would, I suppose, now call a climate change denier. He would say, actually, there's an enormous amount of exaggeration and bad and wrong science involved. And so I thought, as a little tribute to him, we'd hear his point of view now, or one of his points of view, given at something called AV2, which was a whole series of talks back a few years ago. And his talk, this is a little extract from it, is called Challenging Orthodoxy, which you can find online.
All the ice cores that have ever been looked at in the last, 15, 20 years show exactly the same. Up goes CO2. No, it doesn't. Up goes the temperature, followed by CO2. Good old Marilyn Monroe. Thank you. The next slide, please. Yes, Quadivac demonstrandum, firm scientific evidence that carbon dioxide cannot be in the driving seat. Indeed, if we wanted to double the amount of CO2 in the atmosphere, double it from pre-industrial days, the world would have to burn all its known oil reserves, all its known gas reserves, and a third of all its known coal. And even if we cloned Arthur Scargill, we couldn't do that. We really couldn't. We just couldn't put that. And that would raise the temperature by 0.2 of a degree centigrade. So what the hell are we worrying about? And even with the USA working as usual and China and India going flat out, it would be a daunting thing. And I don't think we're going to do it anyway. Next slide. So we're back to my... Oh, no, very dumb, and you've seen it already. The interesting thing that the paper which I produced with my students from that kettle hole was actually published, peer-reviewed, in 1966, just as we were beginning to be warned of a catastrophic ice age that was going to kill us all. Do you remember that? Up into the 70s. Such a scenario had been talked about on a number of times before, and many students counsel that the Earth is in an interstadial, another wobble, not a full-blown interglacial. That is why in those days I worked with Greenpeace and campaigned along with the FOE to get the government to insulate the lofts of pensioners in London to protect them from hypothermia and fuel poverty. We were talking about in those days.
Yeah, well, I'm loath to enter into any technical discussion about the
climate change minefield.
Yeah, it's a climate change minefield. I'm basically a political scientist, a social scientist, and I look at the way knowledge is produced and narratives are made. Now, obviously, you have to simplify if you're going to achieve political goals. But what worries me about the whole climate change movement is it's boiling down the whole social justice issue to one of climate change. When in actual fact, to my mind, I'm an old guy.
Okay.
I think it's about killing foreign babies and destroying
the
communist countries.
There are several major issues around the world, things like food, finance, war.
Well, exactly. I mean, in a sense, climate change has become a way for a younger generation to identify all of those evils and put them all into one pot. Now, I appreciate the effort that people are putting in. And of course, by getting politically involved, they become politically knowledgeable. Yeah? I'm in favour of reducing the voting age to 16. Why not? But that means you've got to start teaching kids about being an active citizen age 12. And then we shouldn't get round that.
Kevin, there is this thing from 1967 called The Report from Iron Mountain, and I think it's subtitled On the Possibility and Desirability of Peace. In the 1960s, apparently, this think tank, including John Kenneth Galbraith, were looking at, well, the Cold War, what they believed was going to finish, and what was going to be the next big threat, possibly climate. But anyway, what do you make of the, you know, what you've heard from David Bellamy there, who died last week?
David was a botanist, and he was a gorgeous presenter. But I think what's one of the things I find important about the whole issue of climate change is if there's a certain balance of chemicals in the air and they're going out of kilter, it's a mistake to ignore it. All the climate change, you know, rows and conferences and everything, at least they're looking at real changes in the real constitution of our atmosphere.
Well, we've also got something called the transhumanists and transhumanism coming down, charging towards us, which is the obsession with technology. Technologies, you know, this idea that hey, guys, you know, your children will live forever. Just pay us the money and we'll do it for you. This is almost like a kind of cult, really, around super science and the idea that we can genetically engineer humans to do all sorts of things in the future. Well, maybe we can, but one of the downsides of all this is the development of artificial intelligence now means that we can get rid of the human decisions that are being involved in warfare, particularly when it comes to drones. And I came across this this week, which is about something called Project Maven, using artificial intelligence to locate and kill terrorists. And I think it could be used for all sorts of people to locate and kill criminals or just someone you don't like.
Here we go,
Kevin. We'll have a chat to you after we've heard this report.
The military is using Project Maven to hunt insurgents. The technology is helping human intelligence analysts identify objects on video feeds from drones that are high up above the battlefield.
Yeah, so it is.
You know, it's kind of like a Facebook photo in how it learns. When you upload a photo into Facebook, Facebook will be able to identify which of your friends are in that photo. And if it doesn't know which one of your friends is in that photo, you can tell it who it is, and then it'll know in all future photos. Project Maven does the same thing. It'll identify a car or a building and put a box around it, just like that Facebook photo, and suggest what it is to the analyst. Now, if it gets it right, the analyst clicks, yes, it's right. But if it gets it wrong, the analyst will correct it. And thus, it learns. You know, in the past, a human would actually have to be sitting at a computer and tag individual objects that he or she sees on the screen. Stuff like people, vehicles, or even structures and houses. Now the algorithms will actually give suggestions of what it thinks those objects are. This collaboration between the analysts and the computer is what has become known within the Pentagon these days as human-machine teaming, and it's become a really high priority to use this type of technology and teaming in all sorts of future weapons that the Pentagon's developing. So the technology is being used primarily in the Middle East region. It was first deployed with special forces, but the idea is to actually broaden who has access to it in the coming year. While it was first only available on small Scan Eagle drones, the idea is to move to larger, higher flying drones like Reapers and Global Hawks, which also happen to have higher resolution cameras. So military officials say Project Maven is doing really well, and it actually gets better as you use it. In its first week of deployment, its accuracy went from 60% to 80%. So you could say it's learning on the job.
Well, I was listening to that, I was thinking, well, this technology supposedly identifies the terrorists who are your enemy. Is it going to come back and kill your general in command because he's the one who's running the terrorists on the ground? And that's because, in actual fact, the whole idea that we are, as a society, attacked by enemies, but there's an inner core where we mean well. In actual fact, what we're talking about here is new weaponry. That's all it is. And it will kill the people you tell it to kill. And, you know, if you are...
But it takes out the human angle on this, doesn't it?
Well,
yes, this is the idea.
Yeah, but
even with a drone operator working up in Warrington or somewhere, up in Lincolnshire, controlling this drone, via Ramstein, I think it is, in Germany, thousands of miles away in the Middle East. The drone is flying around. Even with there is a human element, isn't there?
Well, there is, but also you've decided, well, who do you want to kill, ultimately? It's a decision for the intelligence officers, isn't it? I mean, the drone attack on the Saudi oil facility by the Yemenis, and I think it was by the Yemenis, was an absolutely, you know, it was a very low-tech attack compared to what the big boys are able to do, but it gave the Saudis a bloody nose. And, of course, two can play at this game. It's just a different way of killing people. It's like the invention of the car bomb or the letter bomb.
Mm. Have you noticed, Tony, that one of the things that's not popular is peace? One of the things that's unbelievably popular on game sites and all the, you know, movies, films, is war. So there's a psychosis and it's being peddled. And this is one of the aspects of it. And you said it much better at the beginning. You said, are we going to be killing terrorists or just people who oppose us? And the answer is the second.
Also this week, Russia's only aircraft carrier has caught fire. Martin, I don't know if you've been following this. Reuters saying fire at Russia's only aircraft carrier on kills one person and injures 12 people. And this is the Admiral Kuznetsov. It caught fire on Thursday during work in Russia's Arctic port in Murmansk. Hours later, the fire was brought under control.
Been there, seen it. But you know what an aircraft carrier is in modern times? It's a target.
Russians only have one of these.
Well, that's because
we got two.
This one is not looking too good at
the
moment.
Well, I mean, the point is it's old technology. If there is a war with Iran in the Middle East, the aircraft carriers are going to be shot out of the water almost straight away. The Russians and the Chinese, who are basically land-based powers, have developed land-based anti-ship missiles. Mm. And, of course, the other side are going to have to attack from the sea. But if you think of where the Gulf is, they put the aircraft carrier into the Gulf the other day. I can't remember the name of the Abraham Lincoln, I think it was. Now, if that's in the Gulf, you certainly can't start a war because you just seal the end of the Gulf off and sink all the ships in it. They need to put it out in the middle of the Indian Ocean around Diego Garcia. But even then, you've got to put it way, way out. And, of course, the Russians have now got these missiles, which within half an hour can take out an aircraft carrier from inside Russia.
Well, I think someone should tell the Prince of Wales this, because there was a commissioning ceremony this week held in Portsmouth. Royal Navy's £3.1 billion new aircraft carrier has been commissioned, a ceremony in Portsmouth attended by the Prince of Wales and Duchess of Cornwall. They inspected a Royal Guard made up by the ship's company as part of the event at the city's naval dockyard. Duchess of Cornwall, who is the ship's sponsor, I don't know what that means, has it got her logo on the side of it or something, told the gathering of about 3,000 people that it is the beginning of an exciting new era in our long naval history.
Well, I mean, I am interested to know who the sponsor is. Is it a Virgin Megatrains aircraft
carrier? It's the Duchess of Cornwall.
I see. Well, I mean, aircraft carrier, I mean, the Russians, that Kuznetsov is an ancient piece of kit.
I remember it came through last year.
From the past.
Didn't it come through the channel? It chugged through the channel last
year. That's right. And it was being mocked.
Belching smoke everywhere.
I mean, anyway.
Yeah, a big problem for the climate is the Admiral Kuznetsov.
Anyway, this is our latest aircraft carrier, looking very impressive next to the Queen Elizabeth, or whatever it's called. I think it's it has already been launched. 65,000-ton warship was united with its sister ship, the HMS Queen Elizabeth, earlier this month when the older of the pair returned from the United States. It had been carrying out trials of its F-35B Lightning jet fighters. Now, this is another problem, is that these fighters aren't too good, are they? They've had all sorts of trouble with them, and it's almost as if the fighters are being, the price is being jacked up as the quality of the actual aircraft goes down.
Well, there's an awful lot of the Americans just selling their duff kit to everybody and insisting that they buy it. I mean, the aircraft carriers do have a use. They're no use for fighting the Russians or the Chinese, but if you want to attack, say, Bangladesh or some country that owes you money or whatever, and they've got no defences, then you can park your aircraft carrier nearby and use it as a base for air superiority. Mm. But in terms of taking on the Chinese or the Russians, it's a non-starter. They'll all be in Davy Jones' locker within half an hour of the beginning of the battle.
Years ago, my sponsor in the Army, General John Hackett, wrote a book called The Third World War. And he didn't quite say it, but he might as well have. If Russia and NATO attack each other, the air war will last 2 weeks. After that, there'll be no planes left. And it takes 2 years to build one, and they cost so much that the 2 weeks of fighting would have bankrupted everybody.
So what does that mean for today?
It means that we built two aircraft carriers, which will last 30 minutes in a serious battle, largely to keep, and it's reasonable enough.
It means there won't be a battle, isn't that what you're implying here?
It'd be a great idea if there wasn't, because then we wouldn't lose them.
Love Bristol.
Love, love, love.
BCFM 93.2. Love Bristol.
Love, love, love.
BCFM 93.2.
Well, we'll just do that once, I think, shall we? Anyway, so we're on to the Martin Bormann section now, and I thought we'd hear this extract from a book, from a documentary, actually, called Inside the Nazis, Martin Bormann, where there's a little bit of discussion about his relationships with women. This is Hitler's treasurer and private secretary that escaped at the end of the Second World War, it now certainly appears, although there's rumours of his death for many, many years, and we'll be talking about that evidence that the story by John Ainsworth Davis, by Ian Fleming, Christopher Crichton and the crew actually tallies up with the official story too. But first, Bormann and women.
Bormann, unlike Hitler, played the field. His most passionate affair was with film star Manya Behrens. He graphically described their lovemaking to, of all people, his long-suffering wife. I kissed her without further ado and quite scorched her with my burning joy. I fell madly in love with her, and then I took her in spite of all her refusals. Always adept at covering his tracks, Bormann suggested to Hitler a new party policy condoning sex outside marriage. He issued a document safeguarding the future of the German people, which decreed that producing good Aryan children was more important than monogamy.
We must get a regular motherhood cult going, and there must be no difference between women who are married in the normal way and women who have children by a man to whom they are bound in friendship.
Those illegitimate children would be atheists if Bormann had his way. He took his cue from Hitler, who had little time for organized religion.
The church of today is nothing more than a hereditary joint stock company for the exploitation of human stupidity.
While Hitler had no immediate plans to attack the church, Bormann found any petty means he could to damage it.
Bormann wrote to us. He would like the shopping to be done in future only with members of the party or with people who have a positive attitude towards Hitlerism. We were not to do the shopping with Catholics. And when my wife received that letter, it made no impression. She said, I'll go shopping where I've always done the shopping. I am not going to take any notice.
The more powerful Bormann became, the more hostile was his antagonism to the church. On the 10th of December 1943, he wrote to his wife,
make sure none of the children gets depraved and diseased by the poison of Christmas. I repeat, we must be doubly careful to see that a poison which is difficult to get rid of is not instilled.
Bormann saw religion as the enemy of the people, and yet his eldest son, Martin, would grow up to become a Catholic priest. He would always be left with the legacy of a father who, in the last years of the war, finally won Hitler's agreement for massive discrimination against the church.
Von da ab wurde also der Kampf gegen die christlichen Kirchen.
The fight against the Christian churches was substantially stepped up. The last remaining monastery schools were closed. Many monasteries were dissolved. I only took this in at the margins at the time. The reasons given to us children were, well, we do not need them any longer.
Others brought Hitler problems. Bormann brought him solutions, not least when it came to the question of what to do about the Jews.
One must act radically. When one pulls out a tooth, one does it with a single tug and the pain quickly goes away. The Jews must clear out of Europe. Otherwise, no understanding will be possible between Europeans.
Bormann would listen to these diatribes, note them down, and then pass on Hitler's orders to those who would actually do the dirty work. In a secret order of the 9th of October 1942, he confirmed in writing Hitler's wishes that the permanent elimination of Jews could only be solved in the special camps of the East.
So there's Bormann, from the women to the final solution. But really what I wanted to say something about tonight is the, very quickly, we haven't got much time, is the body of Bormann supposedly found near Friedrichstrasse station. They've said what it contained cyanide, that he'd taken a cyanide pill. Well, that doesn't really go with the story that also that he was shot. And also, of course, the location is exactly where Crichton says he picked them up from, Martin.
Well, if people read Op JB, they will see that in actual fact a body was created so that Bormann could then disappear, supposedly being dead.
Someone had their dental records changed and everything. A doppelganger was sent, and he didn't even know. But one of the things that Crichton says is that they had to keep the two apart so that Gunther, they called him, didn't know that he was going to be shot and his body
left
to be Bormann.
That was part Bormann's. Of the operation. And people can find the book online, Op JB, by the guy who actually carried out the operation under Ian Fleming's command. And the doppelgangers were used quite a lot in World War II. This was before modern DNA analysis
anyway,
of people.
What about
so
Kevin? You got a quick word on the Bormann story? You know much about it?
No, I picked it up through his son, who was
Bormann's son?
Bormann's son, Martin, making reparations for his father, as he saw it.
What was that?
Well, it's part of Catholic doctrine. If somebody is terrible like his father was, you can say prayers for their soul and get them out of hell and all this sort of stuff.
Okay, time to sign off for the US Own Comcast News at 8. Thanks to our guests. That is Clive Stevens from the Greens, also Robert DeVito Boutin, Kevin Cahill, and Martin Summers, you just heard there. We're online at thisweek.org.uk. Here's wishing you a relaxing and enjoyable BCFM weekend. Sister Show Dialects here at Tuesday at noon. Do join us for the politics show at 6 o'clock next week. God bless, and don't let the banksters get you down.
Sky News Centre at 8. Noisy demonstrators have marched through London, passing Downing Street in protest against the Conservatives' election win. They chanted, "Boris Johnson, not my Prime Minister," and carried signs saying, "Defy Tory rule." Earlier, the PM called for closure after years of division over Brexit. Meanwhile, the leader of the SNP has demanded a second Scottish independence referendum, insisting she has a clear mandate to give people a choice. But in a phone call this evening, Boris Johnson rejected the idea, saying the first vote in 2014 was decisive and should be respected. A battle for the future of Labour is underway after the party suffered its worst election result since 1935. Jeremy Corbyn says he'll step down as leader, but not yet. He says he has pride in the party's manifesto, which he claims had huge public support. But Labour MP Wes Streeting says it's been a disaster, and Mr Corbyn and his supporters are to blame.
They had the leader they wanted. They had the manifesto they wanted. They had the national executive they wanted. The Brexit policy they wanted. The political staff and strategy that they wanted, and this is the consequence. So they need to own their failure.
In other news tonight, a Democratic-controlled committee has approved two articles of impeachment against Donald Trump, charging him with abuse of power and obstruction of Congress.